So people should not mistake the forest for the trees here. In the growth of, as we've seen with solar, with wind, and with many other clean energy technologies, there are always temporary setbacks on the road to going mainstream. And I think we saw this. A really good way to think about this is circa 2000, you know, somebody predicting the demise of cell phones, or in 2010 predicting that solar would not be a mainstream technology. You know, cell phones are everywhere. Solar power is now the fastest growing, lowest cost source of energy in the country. Almost all new electric grid capacity additions in the United States will be met with utility scale solar from now to next few years. And electric vehicles are really in that category. The headwinds we were facing this last year included high interest rates and some supply chain constraints, and those are temporary. So overall, what's happening in California, I do think, is a postcard for the nation. We're now at 25% of our vehicles sold being electric. That's up from 8% just when Gavin Newsom took office 5 years ago as governor. And the best-selling car in the state of California is electric. We're the first state where that's the case. And I really see the winds really starting to turn in favor of EVs now very aggressively.
That's the chair of the California Energy Commission, David Hochschild, answering a question from Shannon Osaka, who is the climate zeitgeist reporter from the Washington Post. David was appearing on Washington Post Live. Yes, welcome, folks. This is the latest episode of Climate Conversations, and I'm your host, Robert McLean. This podcast is assembled here in Shepparton, in northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen lands of the Yorta Yorta people. And I pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Join me now as we listen to David Hochschild, who was a guest on Washington Post Live, where the title for the webinar was Driving the Future.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Washington Post Live. I'm Shannon Osaka, climate zeitgeist reporter for the Washington Post. I am happy to be joined by David Hochschild, chair of the California Energy Commission. David, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
It might be helpful to start just by hearing about California's Energy Commission. What it actually does, what's it responsible for?
Yeah, so we're a 700-person state agency with about a $9 billion budget charged with getting California to 100% clean electricity. We're at about roughly 60% carbon-free electricity today. We're also working to electrify almost everything. So we're putting about $4 billion into electric vehicle charging infrastructure. We also set all the codes and standards for new construction. We mandate solar on all new homes, high-efficiency windows, LED lights, and appliances as well, televisions, refrigerators. We set energy standards for all those devices. I'm really working to make a future where everything that connects to the grid is a good citizen of the grid, because there's so much electrification happening now, from heat pumps to electric vehicles, electric school buses, and even the electrification of rail. All that's underway, so we work on all those issues.
When we're thinking about that electrification, obviously EVs are a huge part of that. And we've seen a little bit, I mean, EV sales continue to grow, but we've seen sort of a slowdown in that growth in recent months. I mean, what do you attribute that to?
So people should not mistake the forest for the trees here. In the growth of, as we've seen with solar, with wind, and with many other clean energy technologies, there are always temporary setbacks on the road to going mainstream. And I think we saw this. A really good way to think about this is circa 2000, you know, somebody predicting the demise of cell phones, or in 2010 predicting that solar would not be a mainstream technology. You know, cell phones are everywhere. Solar power is now the fastest growing, lowest cost source of energy in the country. Almost all new electric grid capacity additions in the United States will be met with utility scale solar from now to next few years. And electric vehicles are really in that category. The headwinds we were facing this last year included high interest rates and some supply chain constraints, and those are temporary. So overall, what's happening in California, I do think, is a postcard for the nation. We're now at 25% of our vehicles sold being electric. That's up from 8% just when Gavin Newsom took office 5 years ago as governor. And the best-selling car in the state of California is electric. We're the first state where that's the case. And I really see the winds really starting to turn in favor of EVs now very aggressively.
And the California Air Resources Board has passed a measure that requires all cars, SUVs, pickup trucks to have zero tailpipe emissions by 2035. And, you know, that's getting to 100%. You mentioned we're at about 25% right now. I mean, do you expect that goal to be really feasible? Right now, electric vehicles are still on the expensive side.
Absolutely. And to me, you know, it's not just that it's possible, it's that it's inevitable. If you look at the fundamentals, the battery pack is half the cost of the car, okay? Where are we with battery costs? Well, a decade ago, it was $1,000 a kilowatt hour. We're now in the $135, $140 a kilowatt hour. We fund at the Energy Commission all these next generation battery technologies, Qbert, Spark, Cepion, CoreShell, and so many more. What is coming in batteries is incredibly exciting. It's not just we have technologies that are going to do 70% better energy density, but also a lot lower cost and safer. And so with that, there'll be a tipping point where electric vehicles are not only better, they're cheaper. And that is why the markets recognize this. I think it is worth noting, you know, the most valuable car company in the world is electric car company Tesla. And they're not the most valuable by a little bit. They're 3.5 times Ford, General Motors, and Stellantis combined. And why is that? It's because the market's really rewarding the companies that are furthest along on electrification. And I do want to commend all those other companies for leaning in to electric, the electric Ford F-150 and other vehicles being made now. Incredibly exciting, but this all gets easier and faster and better and cheaper as battery technology improves. The vehicles itself, I mean, I think it's been the case that really everybody who gets an electric car and buys one, it's generally a very positive experience. People tend not to want to go back. I got an electric car 6 years ago. I will never buy another, you know, gasoline car again. This experience is so much better and 90% fewer components and much more reliable, less maintenance. And so I think as battery technology comes down and we get the industry to scale, you'll see a lot more cost coming down. I will say the other piece of this is the charging infrastructure. And so we're putting, as I mentioned, about $4 billion of public funds into EV charging here at the Energy Commission in the state of California. We now have more electric vehicle chargers in the state than we have gasoline nozzles. So we have about 94,000 public chargers in California. Our state goal is just over 1 million. We're about 60,000 gasoline nozzles, but we need to do more of that. We need more fast chargers. Only 10,000 of the 94,000 are fast chargers. And so we're working hard to get that infrastructure deployed. And that is also going to accelerate sales as we do that.
I want to come back to that charging question a bit later, because that is so crucial in this transformation. I'm curious first, though, I mean, we've seen a lot of OEMs, auto companies really invest a lot in electric vehicles. At the moment, you know, still most of the profits are coming from the gas side of the industry, though. I mean, what has been the industry response to California's move here? Have you seen a lot of automakers really embracing this, or has there been resistance?
I don't think there's a single major automaker left in the world that's not developing an electric vehicle model. And if you're in a company that's making vehicles and you're not doing electric, you're kind of betting against the future. And so that is why you're starting to see more and more OEMs accelerate. And some companies announce like they're going entirely electric. And, you know, look at the transition VW has been through, right? And GM and others. And the cars that are coming out are fantastic. I got to drive the Ford F-150 Lightning a few weeks ago. Phenomenal vehicle. And, of course, has all these other wonderful features. You can plug things into it. If you're a contractor driving that car, you don't need a generator because you have the battery pack. So I'm really excited and encouraged generally, globally, by what we're starting to see on electric vehicle models coming out. And I think demand for those is only going to grow. It will follow a very similar model I think we saw with rooftop solar, where if you look at how solar developed, you know, somebody in their neighborhood would get a rooftop solar system, and then the person across the street would say, hey, I want one of those. And you're sort of starting to see that with electric vehicles. Just having more of them out there is sort of the best advertisement, and you're getting a lot of that peer-to-peer adoption going on right now.
We still have a pretty high, you know, EV sale price. And I totally agree with you, having driven EVs before. It is just an amazing experience. It's totally different from the gas car. At the same time, you know, the average EV sale price, I think, was about $53,000 in July. You know, there are car makers like BYD in China that are making much lower cost, much cheaper electric vehicles. I mean, and at the moment, there are certain restrictions that keep those vehicles from entering the U.S. I mean, do you think that has the potential to slow down this transition? Can we wait for sort of the more American automakers to bring those costs down?
Well, so first of all, there are more entry-level vehicles out there with the tax credits. You know, Chevy Bolt is $25,000, and there's others as well, Leaf and so forth. But I think it's really important for buyers not just to look at the sticker cost, but also to look at the cost to operate the vehicle. So it's about half the price per mile to drive an electric car as opposed to conventional. And then your maintenance cost goes way down. You're not dealing with oil changes and air filters and spark plugs and mufflers or any number of other things, including catalytic converter thefts and so forth. It's just, there's 90% fewer components. So your cost to maintain and operate the vehicle is much lower. And when you add that in and you look at a 5 or 10 year horizon, which is the smart way to, I think, approach a decision like this, EVs are already cheaper. The sticker price, as you point out, that is true, but that is a moving target. It's going to move long term in the right direction just because of what's happening with batteries. And a good thing to keep in mind when you look at the bigger picture, okay, what's going to drive battery costs down? Why should we be optimistic about battery costs coming down? And you add up all the industries that are depending on lithium-ion batteries, everything from cell phones to laptops to vehicles to stationary energy storage to all sorts of other things, electric scooters, everything, you name it. All those industries are investing R&D and market demand, which is creating scale. And so batteries follow the same law as every other technology. It's not complicated what drives cost down. It's innovation, automation, and scale. And it's mostly scale. And so that is happening in the battery sector as never before. And so I do think it's worth looking at history. We went through this with solar, with wind, with cell phones, and so many other things. So it's really on that pathway. And that's why I think we do have good reason to be confident that batteries costs are going to continue to come down, and therefore EV costs along with them.
I'm glad you brought up that maintenance side of things. I know it surprises many people I talk to when they get a new EV, they open the user's manual and it says basically first major service except for tire rotations is at 100,000 miles. It's very different than a gas car. I mean, one interesting thing that I've reported on with respect to this maintenance is the sort of car dealership question and whether car dealerships are going to be able to sort of maintain their income levels without as much maintenance, which is obviously a big component. There was a Sierra Club survey at the end of 2022 that found that 30% of the dealers they surveyed didn't want to offer EVs. Now, this may be a different story in California, which has been so pro-EV, but, you know, do you see this as an obstacle for adoption? Have you seen ways of addressing this?
So I think in any transition, there is going to be some change. Okay, so I will say in this case, it is good for consumers not to have to pay as much to have your car serviced. So that is a public good. There are a lot of other new jobs being created, and we need a lot more people working, for example, in EV charging systems and, of course, in battery manufacturing. And let me just highlight for a moment what is happening there. Thanks to President Biden, we have a historic set of tax credits, which are heavily incentivizing bringing battery manufacturing back to the United States. We don't want China to become the Saudi Arabia of batteries. And so there's a huge push, not just for batteries, but also going further upstream for lithium development. We're doing a massive lithium development effort here in California called Lithium Valley. We have enough lithium to provide for 375 million electric vehicles just with lithium from California. And there's a lot of jobs to be found in those sectors. So I don't want to say that everything is going to stay the same, because there will be some change with the introduction and the growth of electric vehicles, but there's also a lot of new opportunities in there. And so for people in car dealerships and so on, I think I could see models changing where, for example, you begin to sell home electric vehicle chargers, and that becomes a whole new business to get those sold and financed and installed. And so there's a lot of new jobs that will come with this, even as some of the other jobs will by necessity wind down, because hopefully people are having to spend less money getting their car serviced and their air filters and oil replaced and so forth.
We received a ton of audience questions, over 200, and a lot of them talked about range anxiety, which I think for folks that have maybe not driven an EV or experienced it very much is, you know, still a really big fear that they won't be able to find a charger or they won't be able to take the road trip that they want to do. What do you say to those folks about, you know, the state of California fast charging and how the state is really building out the infrastructure to avoid that problem?
Yeah, so help is on the way. When I got a Chevy Bolt, my wife and I, 6 years ago, and at the time it was called the Prozac for range anxiety. So 259 miles. By the way, I've had no issues with it. Love the car. I got my parents to get the car, my wife's parents, and honestly about 20 friends at this point. So we have 10,000 fast chargers in the state of California. We are installing many more. One, I think, very positive development around fast charging is what's called NACS, which is the North American Charging Standard, formerly known as the Tesla plug. So Tesla has made that open source, and about 75% of the major auto manufacturers have now announced they're changing to that plug, and that can support up to 1 megawatt charging. Very, very fast. That network is very well maintained. There's 6,000 Tesla chargers in California. That's going to triple in the next 2 years. And then generally with chargers, so we have three levels. There's level one, which is just a home wall outlet, and you can plug that in overnight in your garage. That's very slow. It's about 4 miles of charge per hour. There's level two, which is the vast majority of chargers that are out there, and that's about 25 miles of charge per hour. And then the fast chargers, which is level three, can be, you know, up to 150 miles or greater in 30 minutes. And there's actually a lot of help coming there too. I was, you know, just meeting some companies that are looking at 650 kW charging. So you can do 200 miles of charge in 3 minutes with that, which is an experience that's really not really different than going to the gas station. But one thing to keep in mind, every year for virtually every model of EVs, the range is getting longer. So that actually does reduce the number of times you need to charge. And so with, you know, longer and longer range. And by the way, this has implications not just for passenger vehicles, but for trucking as well. We have 36 long-range Tesla semis operating in California today, 520-mile range from the Pepsi facility in Modesto today. That's fully loaded. So you can see the envelope of possibility sort of expanding really every month with improvements in battery technology. But we're working really hard to get the charging infrastructure installed as quickly as we can, and just to provide that certainty. And to me, the way to think about it, the goal is to be like a cell phone. When you buy your iPhone or whatever phone you use, you never ask the question, where am I going to get electricity to charge my phone? Because electricity is ubiquitous in the built environment. And that's what we're aiming to do for EV charging, just charging accessible everywhere.
We received a few questions about housing and charging and different types of housing. In one of the questions, Frank Milliken from Virginia asks, how will people in townhouse communities without driveways be able to charge their electric vehicles conveniently? This is a question near and dear to my heart as someone who lives in an apartment and has a vehicle that plugs in. I mean, what is California working on there?
Yeah, so I think that is a great use case for high speed level three fast charging. You want an experience that's like going to a gas station. You plug in, you charge up once a week, and you're good. Because there are a lot of places that are just very constrained. They don't have a garage. Parking is tight. The other thing that I think is really promising is actually what Germany's done around public parking on streets, where they're actually attaching EV chargers to light poles along public streets. So you already have the structure and you already have the power. and to make that more accessible for public parking along streets. So those are the kinds of solutions for that use case.
And I think I have time for one more question. I just want to ask about the role of hybrids and plug-in hybrids specifically in California going forward. I mean, I've talked to consumers who find them to be a really good option. You know, you can do your day-to-day driving on the battery, and then for longer trips, you have the hybrid option. I mean, how is California thinking about that going forward?
So I think you make a great point for long-range trips, you know, people who don't have confidence in the charging infrastructure being there. I do think that is kind of what's driving the hybrid demand now. I think that will fade away with charging infrastructure just becoming ubiquitous. And then, you know, again, with a hybrid, you are still having to maintain internal combustion engine and all that goes with that. And so I think that is something that's here for now. But looking ahead, when charging and fast charging is ubiquitous, when the range of the vehicles is longer, we're going to see EVs everywhere.
Thanks so much, David. We're going to be following this pretty closely. It's a huge transition. So thank you for joining us here on Washington Post Live.
You'll find the link for that event, Driving the Future, from Washington Post Live in the show notes. Join me now as we listen to the president and the CEO of the World Resources Institute, Andy Descupta, talk about four climate stories that will define this year.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Stories to Watch 2024. Thank you for joining us. My name is Ani Dasgupta. I'm the president and CEO of the World Resources Institute. There are nearly 2,000 of us spread across five continents, working with our partners to solve the world's toughest challenges in the intersection of people, nature, and climate. Every January, we gather our experts to identify the biggest shifts and the critical decisions that will be made this year that impacts our work and the world. We hope these stories will not only help you understand what is happening as the year unfolds, but why. And more importantly, how it connects to the bigger picture. We won't be WRI if we didn't start with some facts and figures. So here are three. First, 2023 was the hottest year ever recorded. In fact, the last 9 years were all the hottest on record. Climate change is here now. Second, the UN's Global Stocktake Report found that we need to reduce emissions by 43% by 2030 to stay within safe limits of warming. Yet, current commitments put us on track to less than 10% of reduction. The System Change Lab, which looks at real change in the economy and not commitments, similarly found out of 42 indicators, only one, just one, was on track to achieve 2030 targets. Clearly, we are far behind in the fight against climate change. Third, 2023 saw exponential progress in electric mobility and renewable energy. We need every sector to reach a tipping point like these to unleash a new era of low-carbon prosperity. If we make the right choices to shift the system that make up our economy, we can course correct. The real question is, who will make these choices and where? This year, 2024, is a year of elections. If you look at the map behind me, countries like United States, Mexico, the UK, India, Indonesia, all are holding elections. These countries make up over half the world's population. Billions of people will be making serious choices about how they want to be governed and what their leaders' priorities should be. 2024 is the most important election year so far in this century, and it is happening in the middle of a climate crisis. We know elections make a difference for the fate of our planet. Mid-year last year, Brazil reported that deforestation in Brazil and Amazon had fallen by 22%, and further updates suggested it continued to decline. This decrease is seen as a sign that President Lula's policies to curb deforestation are already taking effect. One of our stories to watch from last year. The good news is that nearly every country now sees climate change as a serious threat they must act upon. In December, we saw the power of collective action on the world stage at COP28 in Dubai. Each country had to weigh the interests of its own citizens and businesses with those of the global community. The final agreement of COP28 to transition away from fossil fuel while tripling the world's renewable energy capacity by 2030 was a hard-fought step forward. This looks like great progress. However, global agreements don't always result in real change. Success actually depends on the national policies and decisions that turn them into action. I've just come back from India, where I grew up. Life there is changing fast. The country is on track to achieve its ambitious goal of 500 gigawatts of renewable energy capacity by 2030. It also saw the fastest growth of any major economy last year. Yet, India is still struggling to create enough jobs for its young and growing workforce and cater to the needs of significant population of urban and rural poor. Soon, 900 million Indians will go to the polls to select a new national government. How will politicians wrestle with the immense challenges, such as reducing India's reliance on coal while generating enough energy for the economic growth and jobs that are critically needed? This political dimension is a challenge in every country. There is no single lever that leaders can pull to make changes happen. 2024 demands that politicians across the globe make bold climate choices. However, they need to be able to explain these choices in a way that convinces the majority that their lives will be better off. At its heart, this year's Stories to Watch is about the balance between ambitious national climate action and the ability to bring their citizens along. This is the art and the science of the new climate politics. So join me. Join me on this journey as we walk through four stories to watch this year about the politics of climate change and the key system changes needed to make the transition a reality.
Now we have the audio from a story from the Melbourne Age by Sarah Brooks, which has the headline, Temperature Records Tumble as Perth's East Cops Brunt of Heat Wave. Here is that story now.
The Swan Valley has set a new record for its hottest day ever as a heat wave grips Perth. On Thursday, the Swan Valley reached 45 degrees by noon, while the Perth CBD hit 42.6 and Pierce reached 44.8 degrees by lunchtime. It was the hottest day recorded at Pierce since 2016. Midland, Kalamunda and Ellenbrook hit 44 degrees before midday, with temperatures expected to climb higher into the afternoon. Perth Airport reached 44.6 C at 11:43 a.m., making it the hottest February day since 1997 with 44.9 C. Bureau of Meteorology duty forecaster Luke Huntington said it was unusual to reach such high temperatures so early in the day. "It's very early in the day to see it heat up so quickly," he said. "Normally, you do see those sorts of temperatures around 2 p.m. or 3 p.m., so it was a very quick warming this morning." In the regions, Geraldton recorded the highest temperature for the state, reaching 46.2 degrees. Huntington said it was forecast to drop to 22 degrees overnight in Perth before reaching an expected maximum of 37 degrees on Friday. The weekend is forecast to be cooler in the low 30s. The Bureau of Meteorology issued a severe heatwave warning for most of WA earlier this week, and by Wednesday it was warning locals the mercury would soar to higher than predicted levels in the city, particularly in the eastern suburbs. The severe heat is not confined to Perth, with an extreme heatwave warning in place for parts of the Gascoyne between Kalbarri and Exmouth and inland to Gascoyne Junction. A coastal trough, also known as a heat trough, is to blame for the uncomfortable weather. The highest temperature recorded for Perth is 46.2 degrees on February 23, 1991. A WA Education Department spokeswoman said all schools were open today. On the first day of term on Wednesday, students at six public schools, including Bob Hawke College in Subiaco, were allowed to go home early after air conditioners stopped working due to a power outage.
Now we have a story from The Guardian by Damien Carrington, the environment editor. The headline for the story is, UK heatwave plan urgently needed to save lives, says MPs. The story begins. The UK urgently needs a plan to prevent thousands of heatwave deaths a year as the climate continues to warm, a cross-party committee of MPs has warned. More than 4,500 people died in heatwaves in 2022, the MPs report said, and this number could rise to 10,000 a year by 2050 without action. Heatwaves are silent killers, the MPs said, pushing up heart rate and blood pressure, with those over 65 and with existing health problems most at risk. Mental health is also affected, with the risk of suicide twice as high when temperatures rise from 22 degrees Celsius to 32 degrees Celsius, and poor sleep due to hot nights can cost the economy £60 billion a year in lost productivity, the Environmental Audit Committee, EAC, reported. Next, we go to a story from Climate Wire that has the headline, How a New Law Could Block Kerry's Replacement. The story begins, an obscure section tucked into a defence bill could upend President Joe Biden's ability to replace John Kerry when he steps down as a special presidential climate envoy in a few months. The provision, which took effect in the start of 2023, requires special envoys appointed by the president to receive Senate confirmation, raising the risk that Biden's nominee could be blocked or forced out after serving a temporary appointment. It's not clear if the legally untested measure, a long-time priority of Republicans, would be applied to the climate envoy post, which was created by Biden in 2021, and whose sole appointee, Kerry, a former senator and Secretary of State, was not required to be confirmed. Yes, we've reached the end of this episode of Climate Conversations. Thanks so much for your company. It's been great to have you along. Now, my screen is still alive with stories about the climate crisis, so I'll put as many as I possibly can in the show notes. So go there, read them, make some decisions, and figure out what you're going to do to help us avoid the worst of the climate crisis. Now, I'd love you to follow this podcast, because if you do that, you'll be alerted every time I publish a new episode. So do that. It's simple. Follow it, you'll be alerted. Also, I'm keen to know what you think about this podcast, so you can contact me at r.mclean7@icloud.com. Don't hold back, good or bad, please let me know. Also, I'd love you to share this with your friends. Put it on your networks. Let everybody know what's happening with the climate crisis. Yes, it's an existential threat. We must attend to it, and everybody needs to be on board. So please let them know. Anyway, until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. Please take care and stay safe.